Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, reminding you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you, down the street, around the corner, maybe even right next door. There are men and women who have put their lives on the line for our freedom. Perhaps you've encountered the gentleman we'll hear from this hour.
And maybe you were in his courtroom once upon a time. It's Judge M.W. Del Rey joining us today. And let's go back to before you were a judge. Now, you actually had a taste of the military before you even graduated high school. How did that happen?
Well, I was in the Naval Reserve. Made a couple of cruises, one on the old Oklahoma, and which was sunk at Pearl, and then a two-week cruise on the Perry, USS Perry. And then I got called active duty, and anyway, they didn't take me, and I ended up going into the Air Force.
And that's how you became a POW, shot down on your fourth mission. But I'm curious about this Navy experience. What was that like to be a teenager in the Naval Reserve and sailing with all these guys who are a little bit older than you, getting a taste of that Navy life for 2 weeks at a time? What was that like?
Well, it was, you learned a lot of words, but yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it very much. It's like the National Guard. You know, we have meetings every week. Once a year, we make two-week cruises, and we look forward to those. A very good friend of mine who I got into the Naval Reserve ended up going to the Naval Academy. Then we talked his brother into trying for it, and he made it for the Naval Academy. So
I'm curious, too. And every veteran that I have on the show, I ask to tell me what he remembers about December 7th and how he found out about Pearl Harbor. For you, it had to be a bit surreal to hear that the USS Oklahoma had been sunk when you had been on that ship.
Yeah, I'd been on it.
Well, how did the news of Pearl Harbor impact you at the time?
I was living back. I was back in Tifton. I know that much. I know that we thought we could get them in 6 months, but no, I remember that.
And so after that, I mean, you'd been in the Naval Reserve, so they call you to active duty, and I guess people would assume that you spent World War II in the Navy, but that's not the case. What happened?
Well, as I say, I got there in San Francisco at the receiving station, and this old, I'll never forget this old fat lieutenant commander doctor said, you've got albumin in your urine, we can't use you. I'd had poached eggs for breakfast, but I don't know how that worked. But so I went down to the Air Force, to the Army, a federal building in San Francisco, and they said, oh, hell, we'll give you that. We'll take a couple of tests. And then they said, oh, you're in the Naval Reserve? Yeah, well, we can't do it. Then you'd have to get out. So I go to Los Angeles, and I go to the 12th Navy District, Naval District Headquarters, walk in, and here's a kid on the guard station there. He says, hey, what are you doing? You're AWOL. I said, what do you mean AWOL? He said, well, you're supposed to be in San Francisco. And I said, I went up there, and they bounced me. Oh. So anyway, as I say, I went to work at Vega Aircraft, Lockheed Vega, for just while I was taking prep school for the Air Force tests. So at that time, you needed 2 years of college, and I was just short. And I went down, we took that test. It took 3 days to take that test on 7 subjects. They had spherical trig in there. Some guys hadn't even heard of spherical trig. And when we got out of the test the last day, the guy says, what's the closest way to get to Canada? Let's go there. They don't want us in this Air Force or Air Corps at that time. Oh, God. Anyway, I finally got called. So
you did okay on the test, I guess. The spherical trig didn't throw you.
I think they must have graded on a curve. it was multiple choice, and I'm damn good at those. Essay type, terrible, but multiple choice, I'm good at it because I have the information, but it's getting it out.
Well, I hope you don't have to take any of those anytime soon. So in the Army Air Corps, most guys that I talked to who ended up in that branch of service, they were hoping to be pilots themselves, whether they ended up as bombardiers or navigators or gunners. They wanted to be pilots. Did you want to be a pilot too?
Oh, yeah. I went to primary flying school at Visalia, and on my phone, got checked, and they took 5 of us up that morning. It was the end of the deal, and washed out 5 of us. I don't know why, because I already had my pilot's license. But if they'd have got me through, I'd have been dead. So what's the difference, you know, if I'd have made it through?
Yeah, and we'll find out why when we hear about some of your missions. So they decide that navigation was a skill you were pretty good at?
Well, I went back to Santa Ana, and you had to take this test again, multiple choice. There were three parts to it. Top grade was 9, and I got a couple of 8s and a 9. I know they called me in, the sergeant says, well, we're going to make a bombardier out of you. And I said, I don't want to be a bombardier. I want to be a navigator. And he said, well, you have to go see the major. So I went and see the major, and the major looked at the record. He says, give him what he wants. If he wants to be a navigator, go ahead. I got back with the other guys and found out guys were getting 6s and 7s on that test. But I was, as I say, I knew how to take it. They didn't know how to take the test. And that's the reason I got high, and they didn't.
And why in your mind was it preferable to be a navigator as opposed to a bombardier?
I don't know. I want to be a navigator on B-17 and go to Europe. And that's what happened. I didn't want to get shut down. But I did. Anyway, I don't know why. I know a very good friend of mine from Tulare became a bombardier, and he was the only class of 1938 that I know of that was killed in the war, and he got killed over there looking for me. He said, oh, well, that's another story.
He wanted to go find you because he knew you were a prisoner? Is that what you're saying?
He told my folks when he left, he said he'd find me over there, but he didn't. He got shot down. Jack Russell is his name, yeah. Very good friend of mine.
For you as this young man, and you said you wanted to go over in B-17s and fight this air war in Europe, did you have any idea what that actually meant and what you were actually going to be up against?
No, I didn't know. How do you didn't know? I knew it was going to be rough because we'd already heard a lot. I thought we knew what we were fighting for, but that was it, yeah.
So what was going through your mind as you headed overseas? You leave behind your family here in the States, not knowing if you're going to come back. What do you remember thinking and looking forward to or even dreading at the time?
I was young, remember? We're young guys, and we're not thinking about not coming back. We're not, although I found out from there were guys were getting down about 10% getting shot down every time. And I said, at that rate, we can't make it. And the rest of my crew said, oh, yeah, we can make it. But you didn't think about that stuff. I didn't think about that. Now, some guys couldn't get to the airplane because they were scared to death. I don't know. I never got scared until we started getting shot at. And then that's when I started getting scared. Yeah.
Well, that's understandable. For people who've never been on a B-17 or weren't alive then and don't know what it was like, tell us about being a navigator on that plane, where you sat, and what your duties were.
Well, in Europe, the navigator really wasn't that important. Lead navigator was, and you had to know where you were at all times, so in case you got shut out of the formation and then had to get home. But primarily, you were probably maybe a commissioned gunner. I had a 50 caliber machine gun on the left and none on the right. But we had to know where we were at all times, as I say. And other than that, why it wasn't that difficult. If you go to the Pacific, then the navigator is really important.
But for you, if you're in formation, the lead navigator leading that flight has to be on target. Otherwise, you guys just trust him. But if you get shot down, as you say, then you've got to adjust and plot a new course, perhaps, huh?
That's right. Of course, it's go west and you can get home.
And anybody that has driven down the 99, and that's millions and millions of people who have passed through Tulare on the 99, and hopefully they notice, if they're heading north, off to their right, a B-17 with a yellow triangle and a big black K in the middle of it. And most people say, hey, I wonder what that stands for. You actually know what that stands for.
Triangle K, yeah, it was the 379th at Kim Bolton, yeah.
That's the 379th bomb group, your bomb group. Kim Bolton, England, is where you flew your missions from.
That's right, about 20 miles north of Bedford.
When you got to Kim Bolton, and this is 1943, still pretty early in this air war for America and Europe, what was it like there? What did you find?
Kim Bolton's the size of about Tipton. if that's large enough, but a little place and just an airport. What was tough was like they'd want to check out pilots for night landings, and they'd have to have a navigator on, And that was, we call them circuits and bounces. But that was an interesting little job.
Make you feel like a guinea pig a little bit?
Yeah, that was tough.
So tell me about your first mission. What do you remember about that? How anxious were you for that to happen?
The first mission, I believe, is the one over the Ruhr Valley. On the map, all aircraft deals are in red. The Ruhr Valley is just a big red moon thing there. And when you hit that, it's before you hit it, you get hit by fighters. And then after you hit it, the fighters don't come in and you get you. And I hit that a couple of times, as I recall. And then one time to run to Kiel, which is north, and we couldn't make it there because it was clouded over. That was when we turned back, and there's an island out in the North Sea called Helgoland. And on that island was German fighters, and they attacked us. And that's when my pilot took violent evasive action. It was a little too violent and dropped way down. So wonder we didn't get shot down, because they usually hit guys that are out of formation. But we got back in all right.
That sounds a little exciting. Were you scared a little bit?
Yeah. I think we're always scared a little bit, yeah.
And when those fighters come at you, because of where you are, and you described having a 50 caliber to your left, a 50 caliber to your right, are you firing away trying to get a piece of these fighters?
I had one come through the formation right to my right. All I had to do was fire the gun, because he went right past us. But I thought, if I kill him, he might run into the guys behind us. Well, if a couple of seconds, he's gone. Didn't even fire a shot. I hate to admit that. Mm-hmm. I did fire one down below us to the left and saw smoke come out and reported it, and they just laughed and said, forget it. You didn't get him. Anyway, I had one. We were flying in formation, being shot. Flak's coming. You can hear the flak on your, like somebody throwing rocks on a tin roof. And this one airplane broke off to the right out for a while, and it just happened. It was an accident, I know, because all of a sudden Flak came out there, and he came right back into the formation. I don't know why. I don't know whether it was later I laughed about it, but I think I laughed about it right then. And I was scared to death and still laughed at that guy. That was one of the few times something funny.
Yeah, I think that is an odd juxtaposition, to be flying and flak hitting your airplane and you could die at any moment and you're breaking out in laughter. That had to strike your crew funny.
You know, I'm not sure I did it then or it was later, but I know it struck me as being funny. To be honest, I really don't know whether I laughed then or not, but I know it struck me funny at the time.
Well, it wouldn't be too long until your duties were no laughing matter. In fact, it turned into a matter of life and death. It's time for our first commercial break. When we come back, 92-year-old M.W. Del Rey will tell us what he remembers about August 16th, 1943, a day that changed his life forever, and the seemingly cruel decision by a German doctor that turned out to be quite a blessing.
It's amazing how some of these things work out. We'll pick up where we left off when Hometown Heroes continues next after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef.
Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.